Hello and welcome to the program. You can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Well, I do hope you've recovered from the bad weather last week. It does seem to be a little bit milder today. I know some parts of the country are still affected, and we send our warm wishes out to each and every one of you. We hope we can at least distract you from the misery of the weather for the next hour or so here on Mooney Goes Wild with a repeat of a special documentary presented by Richard Collins for our Nature on One series on the 1st of January this year. It's called The Disputed Toll. It also happens to be the name of a painting which depicts a moment in time when an elephant with its keeper was stopped at a tolled gate en route from Edinburgh to Manchester. It's a great story.
Manchester Airport Service, now arriving into Manchester Piccadilly. Manchester Piccadilly, next station.
I've just arrived at Manchester Piccadilly, the city's main railway station.
This service formed of 6 coaches. Passenger platform 13, please move down the platform.
Manchester is home to the Guardian newspaper, the Halle Orchestra, and 2 of the world's most famous football clubs. The UK's first public library, Oasis, and who can forget Coronation Street. This northern powerhouse has a rich cultural history and industrial heritage. At the heart of the Industrial Revolution, it became known as Cottonopolis due to the vast amount of cotton fabric produced here. Everywhere I go in this city, I see images of bees, from bins to bus shelters. Carved in the sandstone as part of the coat of arms adorning the town hall, and even in the form of bee murals painted by street artists on gable walls. The worker bee is the symbol of Manchester. It represents the work ethic of the city and its reputation as a hive of activity. I'm on my way to the Manchester Museum on Oxford Street, a neo-Gothic building which houses over 4 million items from every continent. It's the largest university museum in the UK, and it serves both as a major visitor attraction and as a resource for academic research and instruction.
Hello, Richard. Welcome to Manchester Museum.
Hello, Georgina. This is a privilege to be here. It's a wonderful museum, and it's a whole area, isn't it, this university complex. There's students everywhere, for miles. I've never seen so many in all my life.
Aye, it's the start of term at University of Manchester. We're right in the middle of the campus.
I'm not here to see a famous locomotive, the Tyrannosaurus Rex casting, or the Egyptian statue which rotates unaided, but rather an unusual painting, Heywood Hardy's The Disputed Toll.
I noticed you looking at the painting, Richard. What do you think of it?
Well, I've seen prints of it, but the real thing is different. It's a new experience almost. I don't know why, but it has to be the real thing to really move you, and this one does.
Yeah, we're really lucky to have the real one on loan from Manchester Art Gallery at the moment, and it's The Disputed Toll by Heywood Hardy, which depicts an elephant named Maharaja and his keeper Lorenzo Lawrence negotiating at a toll gate on the way between Edinburgh and Manchester.
Georgina Young is Head of Collections and Exhibitions at Manchester Museum.
As you'll see behind you, we also have the skeletal remains of Maharaja the elephant that are part of the Manchester Museum collection. So this is an opportunity to bring together two parts of this story that have been spread across Manchester in one place.
How did it come to be here, the original elephant?
So, Maharaja the elephant is a bit of a Manchester legend. The story's been told, embellished, exaggerated a little over the year of how Maharaja came to Manchester, but fundamentally, he was purchased from a menagerie in Edinburgh, and Maharaja needed to be transported from Edinburgh Waverley Station to Manchester, and was supposed to go by train. But the story goes that Maharaja wasn't too happy with his transport arrangements, ripped the lid off his carriage and refused to go by train. And then his keeper, Lorenzo, walked him from Edinburgh to Manchester. And there are lots of stories of the sort of escapades and scrapes that they got into on the way. And you get this sort of idea of Maharaja the Elephant as a real personality, and a personality that sort of chimes in with a little bit about what Manchester thinks of itself, a little bit contrary, a little bit radical, a little bit unwilling to submit to authority. Slip inside
the eye of your mind. The painting, which dates from 1875, depicts an Asian elephant called Maharaja, formerly one of the prize exhibits in a famous menagerie owned by a gentleman called Alexander Fairgrieve and housed in the Scottish capital, Edinburgh. In 1872, when Alexander decided to retire, he auctioned off all of his animals from his menagerie at the city's Waverley Market. There, in the audience on the 9th of April, sat James Jennison, one of the owners of Bellevue Zoological Gardens in Manchester. By the end of the auction, in exchange for the princely sum of £797.10, he was also the proud owner of a baboon, an antelope, a lioness, and Maharaja. He then faced the problem of how to transport such a massive beast from Edinburgh to its new home. Just like me, James thought the best way to reach Manchester was by train. Maharaja had other ideas, however, and unlike me, I hasten to add, he smashed his railway carriage to pieces. There was only one option left. He would have to walk.
When Maharaja arrives in Manchester, he goes to a zoo that's no longer there called Bellevue Zoo, and is a star attraction, incredibly popular with the people of Manchester, and he's a very long-lived elephant. And the museum had an arrangement with Bellevue Zoo that when significant animals passed, which obviously you never want to happen, but it's a kind of natural part of the life cycle, there was a kind of arrangement whereby they'd be considered as specimens for the museum thereafter. And in this case, it was pretty much impossible to say no.
But do you have the full skeleton?
So what's still here today is the skeletal remains, and not quite all of the skeletal remains. So if you look at his front, if you look at his face, there's part of his tusks missing. Mm-hmm. So the front section of his tusks, which again, if you look at the painting, are connected by a bar, because he was a kind of a kept animal. He had a metal bar affixed between his two tusks. So that section of his tusks were removed and actually were sold with the painting at auction. But the rest of the skeleton was retained at Manchester Museum. And skeletal remains are a lot easier to look after. A stuffed elephant is quite a thing, quite a large thing, quite a difficult endeavour. So the skeletal remains are a lot easier thing to retain than the whole body.
As Georgina has said, Manchester Museum is not the permanent home of the disputed toll. It is normally housed about a kilometre away in the Manchester City Gallery on Mosley Street, which is my next port of call.
So because we are not standing in front of the painting, because it's on loan to the museum across the town, I've got a picture of the picture on my laptop, and when I open it up, press here, it comes up. I've not cropped it, have I? You can see the whole thing. So what we're looking at is a very grey and beige sort of overall tone. The sky is completely clouded over. That's a Manchester sky, and that takes up almost half of the picture. Below it, some gently rolling greenish-brown hills, and then into the foreground, you're looking at a beige colour road that curves off to the left. So that's the picture from top to bottom. Now, across the centre of the picture is a whole contraption of wooden gate. So there's a big five-bar gate, barring the whole of the road from us, and next to it a little pedestrian gate. And behind the gate, you can see, dominating the whole picture, is a massive, dark-coloured bull elephant with huge long tusks that are joined by a bar at their pointed end, so that he's not going to charge at you and gore you, presumably.
Maharaja's trip by foot from Edinburgh to Manchester took 10 days, accompanied by a renowned and flamboyant animal keeper called Lorenzo the Lion Tamer Lawrence. It was on this long walk that the incident immortalised in Hardy's painting is supposed to have occurred. The disputed toll shows Maharaja accompanied by Lorenzo and with a metal bar linking the tips of his tusks, barred from further progress by a white wooden gate. On the other side of the obstruction, his loyal dog beside him, a man in a beige overcoat is engaged in an animated exchange with the exotic pair. The man in question is the tollkeeper, and the thing that's exercising him is the question of what toll an elephant should pay in order for the gate to be opened and for the travellers to be permitted to continue on their way. The toll for a person, a horse and a cart were all perfectly clear, but nobody had considered that an elephant might one day come that way. Hannah Williamson, Curator of Fine Art at Manchester Art Gallery.
Next to the elephant behind the gate is his keeper, that's Lorenzo. And he's a sort of theatrical-looking man standing fairly assertively with his feet quite far apart. He's got a moustache and a little fur cap on. And he is talking to, or rather, it seems maybe arguing with, a man slightly further in the foreground who's just come out of his toll booth to the right. He's an older gentleman wearing a beige smock, and he's remonstrating. It looks like he might be gesturing towards a piece of paper pasted onto the gatepost next to him, which might have on it, we're speculating because we know the story, a list of prices. So these are the tolls that you might have to pay to go through that gate. Maybe there's one for a rider on a horse, a pedestrian, a horse and cart, but we can be pretty certain there won't be on it a special price for an elephant, hence the dispute. And just behind the man who's the toll booth keeper, also joining in the conversation, it seems, is a small dog, possibly a Manchester Terrier, because he's sort of black on his back and tan-coloured on his paws. And he seems pretty aggressively underlining his master's point that you can't come through here unless you pay the price for a... Well, that's the dispute. So, leaning his trunk over the gate, the elephant is just curling the tip of it round the third bar down. And this is the beauty of the picture, that he's just about to do the thing that makes the story a story. He's not paying a charge, but instituting a charge of his own. He's going to lift the gate off the hinges or destroy it in some way and just walk on through.
Well, it's almost monochrome, this painting. There's no primary colours in it. It's almost a photograph in a sense, isn't it? Very realist, I think, you know. And it's poised at the moment, the climactual moment, when the dispute is about to be solved by the elephant. It's as though he's hearing the two of them talking and he realises what's up and he puts his trunk over and lifts the gate and walks through. He's brighter than the two of them. That's the impression.
He is bright, and he's an individual here, isn't he? Because he's got that sparkling eye that's looking out at you, and he's right in the centre. Yeah. So it's like we're meeting the elephant's eye. We know who's the clever one here. Well, the two idiots at the side are having a fight.
The elephant is the hero, and he's the portrait. It's a portrait of the elephant. Hayward Hardy, Hannah, would he have been asked, commissioned to do this? Or was he somebody who went around looking for interesting scenes and decided to paint this one?
I think your second option is the right one here. It wasn't a commission. It was a fun painting, which he knew would find a market. It was reproduced in the graphic magazine of that year because it is a popular subject. I don't know if it sold straight away, but it definitely did find a buyer eventually. It belonged for a long time to friends of the family that owned Bellevue Zoo in Manchester. The artist himself, he's a good one to collect because he was popular and in demand from 1870 onwards when he came back to London. Because he'd trained in Bristol, where he grew up, and he'd been to Paris and to Antwerp, and so he'd really honed his skill. He didn't just paint elephants, he painted portraits and genre scenes, you call them, story pictures, and animal pictures particularly. But I've seen reproductions of some of his other works, and he does a lovely horse.
Following after Stubbs, who used to do lovely horses, and that's a great tradition of that. But he would have had his eye on the box office when he painted this. He might have been commissioned to paint it, but he knew he was going to sell this one and he's going to make a few bubbles. He makes his living by painting, does he? He's not an aristocrat who paints in his spare time or whatever like that.
I don't think so. I think he did make a living. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a living you had to tread quite carefully as a Victorian animal painter, because you wanted to be respected as a proper artist, so you had to put some kind of nobility or majesty into a scene, but on the other hand you wanted to sell, so it was fun to do, you know, dogs that looked like they were having a conversation or fun kittens, but then that might lower your tone a bit and therefore lower your prices. So you've got to tread the line between popularity and respectability as an artist, and what better subject than an elephant to do that, because they are clearly majestic beasts, but also, you know, fun.
So there's a moral built in. It's right, the old masters, who always have a moral built in. It's always referenced elsewhere, that sort of thing. Is it? Is he preaching something, saying something? Is there resonance with other aspects of life than just getting through tolls?
I mean, it could be actions speak louder than words.
Yes.
Couldn't it?
Yes. The noble elephant can't teach us a thing or two, or something like that. Mm-hmm. But it stretches beyond itself. Is there symbolism here? The elephant is giant. It's kind of life is bigger than the disputes we have between each other over the cost of the toll.
I like that interpretation. Mm-hmm. I like that. Because there's a bit of emphasis on the way he's been painted as sort of the wrinkles at the top of his trunk. It points to a view of permanence or old age. And
transcendence.
So, bingo! Transcendence, I like that word, yes. So the elephant rises above all this pettiness by being solid and permanent and ancient. And that's what teaches us a thing or two, right?
And he's the noble one in the film. The other two are, you know, small people in their way. Although the fellow collecting the money is a big hulk of a guy. He's a kind of counter-elephant. But the two of them are fighting, squabbling over trivia. The elephant is noble. He transcends it, doesn't he? I think. Maybe I'm reading too much into it.
No, I honestly don't think you are reading too much into it. I think the fact that he towers above them, makes them look petty, emphasises that. I mean, we're not to imagine that they're evil. They're just, you know, distracted by lower worldly things. Where the elephant... Oh, God, the elephant's got his head in the sky, in the clouds. I mean, talk about the positioning of his eye above there. He's up there thinking of higher things. The people are bound to earth, gardening their little hollyhocks. You can see at the side. He's got a little garden, his little preoccupations. He's caught up in the world. The elephant teaches all about eternity.
Yes. Well, this gallery must have wanted this picture a great deal, didn't it? Because it's the place for it, isn't it? 19th century, almost an old master. I'm very mean, aren't I? I won't describe him as an old master. But tell us about getting it and the need to have it.
Yes, Manchester really wanted this painting. It was the subject of a public appeal for funds, actually. And what they did was they photographed it in very high resolution, and you could buy a print of it. You could, on two levels, you could buy either a plain print or a framed one or a fancy framed one. Oh, it's three levels. Three levels! They understood that there was popular support for its acquisition, and they fundraised. We also did get support from the Heritage and Memorial Fund, I think it was, and the back in the 1990s, it was the National the Museums and Galleries Commission, it was called. So there was outside funding sought, but also members of the public were asked to contribute by buying a reproduction of it. It is the fitting place for it. The only reason that it was difficult to get hold of for Manchester was that when it came up in auction, that was in Canada. And the reason it was in Canada was because the head of zoology at the Bellevue Zoo in 1952 was a Mr. Gerald Iles, and he really wanted to own this picture. And so he went to a descendant of the Wilde family that owned it, offered them £20 for it, and was refused. But then Mrs. Wilde offered it to him instead as a Christmas present, and he was really happy to own the picture. It did hang at Bellevue Zoo, where he worked. But then when he left the zoo, I think it was 1957, and went to Canada to live. He took the painting with him. So eventually, when he sold it, I suppose he must have been downsizing, came up for auction in Canada, and then it was bought by a dealer in New York. So it, I mean, there were shipping costs as well, presumably, for the gallery at the time. So it wasn't easy to get hold of, but they knew, because the skeleton is at the museum of Maharaja, and Bellevue is still within living memory a fantastic day out for all the family, only shut it in 1977. They knew that this was the place for this picture, and so it was worth mounting a campaign for. And that was in 1990, so fairly recently, if you're old like me. Certainly is a popular painting. We were so happy here at the art gallery when the museum across town wanted to borrow it, because we hadn't had it on display for a few years. And what with them having Maharaja's skeleton, it's in their foyer. It's so visible. As soon as you set foot in the museum, you see it. And this painting is right near to it. So it's a popular painting. And thank goodness it's out on display again.
Although Maharaja's unusual journey was documented at the time, it's fair to say that the full story came to light in a book titled The Elephant Who Walked to Manchester by the late David Barnaby.
The Elephant Who Walked to Manchester by David Barnaby. Part 4, The Journey.
There have been, said the Edinburgh Daily Review of the following Saturday, several interesting little scenes at the railway station on the occasion of dispatching to various parts of the country the wild animals recently sold at Wombwell's Menagerie.
James Jennison's total purchases for the Bellevue Gardens in Manchester were Maharaja the elephant, Victoria the four-year-old pregnant lioness, one Hamadryad baboon and one Nilgai. They were booked onto the 10:05 express train from Waverley Station on Thursday, the 11th of April, 2 days after their sale. Both Maharaja and Victoria created disturbances at the station. Victoria, however, remained safely enclosed in her crate. It was normal practice for a few horse boxes to make up part of the train. One of these was reserved for the elephant. Lorenzo accompanied Maharaja to the station and was to travel with him. Whether or not in the horse box with the elephant, we do not know. That might have been dangerous, but not outside the bounds of Lorenzo's character.
Maharaja was coaxed into the horse box, and the doors were closed. There were probably a few smiles or grunts of satisfaction from the men concerned as the doors closed. A potentially difficult moment was over. Then, Maharaja's head appeared through the front end of the wagon, not without the sound of splintering wood. For an elephant accustomed to pushing loaded wagons into line and moving loads that were too much for the horses, the wooden end of a horse box was no problem at all. He had simply pushed out the woodwork. Railway officials gathered in alarm, and Lorenzo watched. A raging elephant in the station was something the railway company had to take very seriously indeed. In any case, the express was due out in a matter of minutes. The chaotic scene of smashed woodwork, alarmed officials, and fleeing passengers was intensified by the noise emitted by the elephant. His famous docility was abandoned, at least for the moment. One report described the noise as an angry growl, another as a loud snorting.
That passage, read by David Barnaby, was recorded by his friend Anthony Marlowe.
David Barnaby was a very good friend of mine. He had a keen interest in natural history and zoological history in particular. He was particularly interested in the history of Bellevue Zoo, Manchester, being a Mancunian himself. And he came across the story of Maharaja, the elephant, having been bought at auction in Edinburgh and walked all the way to Manchester. And he decided that this would make a good book. He was a writer and a teacher, so he'd written a number of articles and books before, so this was something else he thought it would make a good story. He reckoned that the elephant must have walked down the main highways from Edinburgh to Carlisle, and then Carlisle to Manchester. And so he decided to retrace the steps, looking in public libraries at newspaper articles at the time to see if he could find any information. And I actually went with him on this trip. And we found quite a bit of information. We decided that Maharaja and his keeper must have travelled about 20 miles a day. Some newspaper articles only contained a sentence or two, but others were much more helpful, particularly Kendall, I remember, which mentioned that the elephant had stayed at the White Hart Inn. And we went to the White Hart Inn, which is still there, and had a drink there and told the landlord, who viewed us with deep suspicion.
But why did you decide to record David reading his book?
David had asked me to help him record something else a few years earlier, because he knew my interest in tape recording, and he thought this would make a good project if we recorded extracts from the book, and then he could distribute them on cassette to various people who might be interested. So we set about recording it. It's about 1990. We just set up in the living room with a desk microphone and a reel-to-reel tape recorder. And once we'd done all the readings, I went through the tapes and edited out all the mistakes and retakes. And then we went through it all again to cut it down to make sure it would fit on two sides of a C90 cassette.
Part 5, The Disputed Toll. On their journey, Lorenzo and Maharaja undoubtedly passed through a few toll gates. On one such occasion, a dispute arose between the gatekeeper and Lorenzo about how much it cost for an elephant to pass through. The dispute grew heated and was solved only when Maharaja either lifted the gate off its hinges or simply smashed it down with his head. Either way, Lorenzo and Maharaja proceeded peacefully on their way, leaving a furious toll gate keeper behind them.
While it would have been very unusual to encounter an elephant walking the highways and byways of Britain in the 1870s, it's not at all unusual to expect an elephant to walk long distances. In the wild, these massive mammals often need to travel in order to find food and especially water, and have been recorded walking up to 200 kilometres in a single day and running at speeds of around 40 kilometres per hour over short distances. Their huge feet and robust build make them superb endurance athletes, easily capable of walking the 300 kilometres or so between Edinburgh and Manchester. Of course, nobody is actually going to choose to transport an elephant to a new home like that today. The chaos that would ensue doesn't bear thinking about. A proper health and safety nightmare. So how are the largest land animals on Earth transported between zoos and wildlife parks in the modern era? Jerry Creighton is a former operations manager at Dublin Zoo. In 2020, Jerry decided to leave Dublin Zoo to found an organisation called Global Elephant Care.
Let me just give you a quick brief history on some of elephant moves where, and can still happen and has happened, where lack of resources are put into it, but I won't deal with that. Part of my company with Global Elephant Care is kindness is the only way we'll do it. And what they would do and have done and are still doing in certain situations is they winch elephants in. Let me explain what that means. They would sedate the elephant to the point where you could go in and stand there. It's called a standing sedation. They would then put a chain bracelet on the elephant, and then you have a winch and you pull the elephant in screaming. That's the bottom line. They come in with screaming and pull
screaming.
Screaming.
The elephant is screaming. Because
it's
even though he's sedated.
You know, you have to reverse the sedation to make the move. You have them sedated to put these chains on them safely.
Then.
So then they're winched in using a mechanical winch. So recently, just to bring things into perspective, I get a call from Belfast Zoo. And Belfast Zoo rang me, said, Jerry, we've got two beautiful elephants. I know them for a long time, Yeto and Dunya. They both had serious bone issues from the previous history. Belfast done an amazing job and took them on, you know, their later years to give them a life. But Belfast quite rightly said, our facilities can no longer support geriatric elephants. So there's a zoo, Burger Zoo in the Netherlands, which can and has a facility specifically for geriatric elephants, for kindness and care. So they called me up and they said, Jerry, we need to get these two elephants into a box. Now, we'd like to do it, travel crate, we'd like to do it fairly soon. I said, okay, let me have a look. So anyway, we brought in a company called Akipa, And they gave us the crates. And I said, I'll do it with you, Belfast, on one deal. If I don't succeed after 6 or 7 weeks, we wait till next year and you give me more time, because it's a fairly short time frame. But we don't winch. And Belfast were absolutely not a chance of us going to winch these elephants. Whereas, listen, it's important that we know. These elephants had bone defects and walked really uncomfortably and very sad lives, you know, in human care between the circus and the logging camp. Belfast, as I say, had done a tremendous job. I started training them. I brought some of the keepers up from Dublin Zoo to help and support me. My daughter was up there. Anyway, I said, after the first week, I'll tell you whether we're having a success. The elephants would come out sometimes in the morning. It would take them 40, 50 minutes to walk maybe 10, 12 metres because it was an old environment. And although the keepers did our very, very best, it was no longer suitable for elephants. Anyway, I started introducing the target sticks and the reward-based training. So after about a week, the elephants would literally, old girls in their 50s, but they would come out as fast as they could. Oh, Jerry's here with the rewards and the training and the system. After the second week, Alan Cairns was a very compassionate man and wanted the very best for his elephant team. And the elephant said, how do you think we are? I said, we're doing okay. Give me another week and I'll tell you for sure next week. And the elephants just loved the response to the kindness and understanding the process. One of the elephants I had to train to reverse into the crate, would you believe, so she wouldn't be sitting over the exhaust when she was on the truck. But after 7, 8 weeks of pure kindness, both elephants on the day walked in. I had to train them to, they had to have a bracelet on their leg because by law, so they can't try turn or swing. But I use now a strapping bracelet, no more chains. It's like a big belt, like you would have around your waist. They have it, so it's kind. But after 7 weeks using, you know, kindness and reward-based training and giving them a choice, on the day of loading, both elephants went into the crate with no problem at all, and we brought them off to the Netherlands, where they're now being introduced to two females there. So a brilliant story showing you that you can do it correctly. And, you know, as I said, the one thing that I am learning, and, you know, I'm very happy to question zoos. I'm an avid zoo lover, and I love Dublin Zoo and my time there, but we have to evolve. We have to look at ourselves. We have to evaluate every year. And the significant changes in zoos that are keeping elephants, as I said, a lot of them are saying, hands up now, okay, we can't do it no more, thankfully. And these, a lot of them are city zoos in towns across Europe. Again, German zoos, very small areas and a lot of spaces. And in the USA, like, a lot of elephants are being moved to the Tennessee sanctuary because zoos are saying that we can no longer do it. But then there's some zoos that are saying, yes, we can. Like, as I say, in Alain, I'm developing an elephant safari with the team there that's going to be 20 hectares. Now, this is where elephants will come out in the morning and not, but it won't be locked in. But what I'm saying is we bring them into the house where we rejuvenate. Massive topography landscape changes, bringing in some machines and diggers, changing it every couple of days, creating destinations, creating journeys, creating purposeful movement, because that's what they have. Elephants only move with purpose, direction, and a reason. So that's what we need to do. No longer walking around in circles in a zoo or rocking from side to side. You look at an elephant that has stereotypical behavior, particular circus elephants, okay, where you see the sway in motion, rocking from side to side. Then look at a walking elephant. It's the exact same motion, except one is moving and one is not. And this is the problem. So thankfully, it is becoming less and less and less a problem. But we need to keep working. We need to keep, you know, that passion going. Incredible species to work with. Empathy, emotional intelligence. You know, we can learn so much from them. I, as a human being, have learned so much from them. And, you know, that's why I want to keep on doing what I'm doing. You know, I'm working with Howlett's Wild Animal Park in the UK, where we're on the verge of, for the first time ever, for elephants in human care going back to the wild, to Africa, which will be remarkable. You know, then hopefully then more zoos will say, yes, we can do it. Because, as I say, I love zoos, but I'd love to say that, and maybe sometime in the future we won't need zoos. But, you know, I am very encouraged by the transition from old days to the new days for elephants in human care, because they're sentiment, they're kind, they're caring, and we need to be the same.
Jerry, I'm going to take you back to the 1870s in Edinburgh.
Okay, yeah.
Now, there was an elephant called Maharaja. You probably know all about him. But anyway, yes. Maharaja was sold to a zoo in Manchester.
That's correct. Yeah.
And the story goes that Maharaja was marched down to the local railway station, yeah, and put on a wagon. And the story has it that Maharaja went berserk and wrecked that place.
Yes, yes.
Now, is that possible?
Very possible. And because I'm obviously familiar with the story, as I like a lot of the historical elephants, I would nearly be able to predict what went wrong there. Remember, that elephant was probably on a ship for many, many months. You know, and that's the way they were transported in them days. And, you know, they were brought in and they would be kept very confined, most likely roped and chained in a very small space. Then, like that elephant was living in a menagerie in Edinburgh. So, you know, in terms of his quality of life, it would have been significantly improved from the time that he was transported. So all of a sudden then, obviously, there was a deal to move him down to the zoo at Manchester, which happened in them days. It was all train. And he was brought then to the local train and railway station. Mm-hmm. So immediately, remember, elephants don't forget. You know, and immediately he would have had a very, very negative association with a confined space because of his previous history. And it all makes sense to me because you could see. And he was probably, they got him into the crate or container or back whatever they were using on the train, and he just went berserk because I ain't having this again. Again, this is how they would react. And I've seen it with many different species over the years. If they have a bad experience with a confined space, you can expect consequences. So he just probably wrecked the train, which he said, it's documented that he turned the inside of the train and smashed it to pieces. But I mean, I'm thinking, I'm in the elephant's corner here now. And that would have been a historical reference to how he had been previously transported. So that would make sense. So then, of course, then the decision to move him and walk him down, which was very, very doable. Like in March the 9th, just a quick one, in 1882, two elephants arrived here at the docks from Liverpool, but via Burma in Dublin, Rama and Sita. And they were walked up through the city. There was thousands and hundreds of people when they came out to see them. So it was a much shorter distance. But what I'm saying is it was replicated on a much bigger scale from Edinburgh to Manchester. So that was probably the reason why. So it is very feasible that they would walk 20 kilometres a day or 20 miles a day.
Well, suppose you were the one that had to walk the elephant from Edinburgh down to Manchester. How many men would you need to look after the elephant on the way? How much food would you have to bring? How would you... water? How would you go about it? What sort of logistics would be involved in a 10-day walk? Almost 300 kilometres, for God's sake. What would be involved with you? And no tranquilizers, remember?
No, in them days. But you see, again, there was probably an element of training with that elephant. And like we've just spoke about, I'm sure he was used under the hook. You know, there was somebody there, like a Mahout-style management time, using the pressure and the hook, so the elephant was still under control. They probably had a leg shackle that he couldn't take large strides. You know, that's the way it was managed. They would chain the front legs that he would only be able to move at a certain pace. So there was probably quite a few people involved in that. But it was very much, you'd have people reminding them all the way, probably hitting them with canes or sticks, so just keep going, keep walking. The food would be the easy part, believe it or not. You know, you would have bales of hay or some type of hay, or along the way you could be breaking branches and letting them graze for a half hour or feed or more, because they're mega herbivores, and what you would get along the roadways between, you know, Edinburgh and Manchester is very edible for an animal. And then there would have been far less road traffic and plenty of places to stop and allow them to break branches. That would have been the easy part. And of course the water you could have probably got, you know, locally too, or brought them to a river or kind of let them bulk up and off they go again. It's very feasible, you know, using the time and the era that was there. And elephants will walk, and they'll walk great distances particularly, you know, but it would have been a lot of management. There would have been a lot of toughness on the elephant. He would have had known, particularly after what he had done, you know, at the train station. I'm sure they roughed him up and kept him very focused on don't do anything wrong. You know, it's just one of the tragic tales of the past, but the main thing is it was the past, and thankfully things are different. But it's sorry, as I say, it happened here on a smaller scale where they came up the quays. That was what was happened. You know, and these animals, when you think of it, like these animals when they came from Burma, when they came to Dublin, and now in 1882, we're probably had to be on the ships for months.
Well, now wouldn't it be better to do it at night? After all, the elephants are more active at night, and no horses and carts in the way, or no people along the way. Would they have done it at night rather than during the day?
Probably not, because, you know, obviously they were thinking it was easier to watch and keep and look at the elephant as he was moving through daylight. Remember, normal elephant biology and normal elephant behaviour happens that they're nice and active at night when they have the resources to go looking for in their natural habitat. This was a very artificial situation, a very managed, a very controlled situation for the elephant. So, you know, it was probably more logical that they moved them during the day and they were resting at night, because the men needed some time to get ready for the next day. So, you know, just move them during the day. And nobody, absolutely no, zero thought was there for elephant wellness or welfare or care. The object was to get them to the zoo in Manchester. Simple. And whatever it took, they would have done. But you can imagine it would have been a pretty brutal process, a pretty, you know, hard. And I'm thinking of an elephant, and I would have loved him to know what way his feet were when he got to the other end of that journey. Although they probably weren't the hard tarmac had him roads that we have now. There was probably plenty of times where he was walking along by a riverbank or a trailway. Hopefully that, because it would have been pretty excruciating, the natural, you know, the briding and erosion of the nails on a hard substrate. You know, it's awful to think about.
substrates wouldn't be that hard back in that time.
No, that's true.
It would be all right, I suppose. Yeah. But anyway, the climax of the story then I want to ask you about. They come to a toll gate and a row develops between the Mahouja, the keeper, or whatever you call him, and the fellow who's collecting the money. And in the meantime, so the story goes, our elephant stretched his trunk over the gate, lifted it off its hinges and walked on through. Yeah. Is that possible?
There's probably a little bit of artistic license in that one, you know, as time with stories. But then again, I'd be thinking from the elephant perspective, and it's probably an animal that, you know, had been walking and was motivated, and it could have been literally the grass is greener on the other side. The animal could have been hungry. He could have wanted to get whatever resource was the other side. And it wasn't that he was fighting with the man for holding him up. His mission was to get over there and get food or get water. And that could have been the reason why. But, you know, the momentum was stopped and there was a barrier. Again, it could be a historic thing in his previous, you know, way he was managed or transported. What's this in front of me? I want to get it out of the way. Like, it could have brought back a flashback to confinement, you know. So there's a lot of logic to it. And I'm looking from the elephant side here. I could see, you know, a barrier or whatever it was coming down in front or that needed to be moved. I want to go through it because the confinement, it all adds up.
So there is no question that Maharaja the elephant could easily have walked from Edinburgh to Manchester. That much of the story is perfectly believable. But we also know that his keeper Lorenzo was a consummate showman who understood the value of a good story and of generating hype. Can we trust his assertion that Maharaja really lifted the toll gate off its hinges? After all, elephants don't have hands, or do they?
The trunk is a very interesting thing because an elephant can do all manner of things with its trunk, and it protects its trunk very cautiously. This appendage is of vital importance to the animal. In fact, I think in a way it compares to our hands, human hands, because obviously elephants have got these great big clumping feet, so there's no way that there's anything like a hand. Whereas a trunk, in many ways, serves as a hand.
Errol Fuller is an acclaimed writer, painter, and world authority on animal extinction, as well as the author of Elephant, a book which celebrates these glorious animals and sheds new light on how they perceive and interact with the world.
The elephant has a long, long evolutionary history. Its closest relatives today little creatures that you would never imagine were related to it. That it's something called a hyrax that lives in Africa and is, well, it looks a bit like a gigantic rat, but it's only about 2 feet long. People often think that the elephant might be related to the hippopotamus or the rhinoceros, but it's not. It comes from a completely different evolutionary line. And then it gradually developed to look a little bit like the things that we know today. The Indian elephant, the Asian elephant, I should say, and the African elephant. That's all that remains of this great lineage of elephant species that once lived on this planet.
This is a wonderful book. It seems to me all elephant life is there. It's very comprehensive. It's very holistic. It includes everything. History, the nature of the elephants, the various kinds of elephant and their evolution, and an extraordinary amount of wonderful stories about elephants in culture, things that happened and strayed. This is a very important animal. It's a kind of cultural icon, really, you know.
Well, it absolutely is. And the reason, or one of the reasons why I wrote the book, is there are hundreds of books on elephants, but they all seem to be on the idea of my 12 years with elephants in Botswana or my 6 months spent in some nature reserve somewhere in Africa. As far as I know, and I might be wrong about this, there is no book that actually tells the story of the elephant in its entirety. Like my book has chapters on the African elephant, the Asian elephant, the elephant in prehistory, elephant curiosities, like the fact that they paint these weird pictures, the elephant in art and literature, ivory, of course, because that's very important, and conservation. There doesn't seem to be another book that actually tells the whole story, and I wanted to do that.
Can I ask you, you have a wonderful collection in your home in Tunbridge Wells. I was privileged to visit you on two occasions and see this wonderful thing.
I remember.
Now, there are these pictures that elephants draw. Ones illustrated in your book are quite remarkable, the elephant self-portraits and things.
I have got one, not a very good one, but I have got one. It's a remarkable thing, and various people say it's just a trick because the owner of the elephant stands next to the elephant, provides him with the paint and the canvas and tweaks his ear and things from time to time. And people say, well, he's just telling the elephant what to do. But the elephant then produces this picture of a flower, a tree, or another elephant's head. And that picture looks just as if a seven-year-old child had done it. Now, obviously, the elephant wouldn't do the picture unless the materials were given to it. But it's still remarkable that it can actually draw something that you and I will recognise for what it is.
And do you think that he's sort of trained like a circus trick to draw a flower? And when he gets it right, he gets a reward. And when he doesn't, he gets a prod in his backside or something.
I think that's certainly true. But that's what we do with five-year-old children. We train them. If a child draws a house and hasn't put a front door in, we tell it to put the front door in. And I think this is kind of an example of just how clever these creatures are. I mean, the feeling is, and I used to believe this, that the African elephant was intractable and couldn't be trained. But when I looked into it, I discovered there are many examples of African elephants being trained. The training aspect was kind of a human cultural thing, that the humans in Africa didn't see any point or didn't dare try to train the elephants, whereas the Asian peoples did.
I think that's down to violence or aggression. I remember talking to zookeepers about it. If you go to zoos, you find predominantly it's Asian elephants they have.
Yes,
seldom do you find, you do sometimes find African elephants in zoos. And the suggestion was that it's much more difficult with them. They're more bulky and they're aggressive and unpredictable and dangerous.
Well,
is this true? There is
no doubt that the male African elephant is a dangerous beast. And they have, African elephants have a slightly different social structure to Indian elephants. A rogue male African elephant can be highly dangerous. And they have something called mushed, which is a period when they become sexually very driven. And the male elephant then is real trouble to other elephants and to anything that it comes across. So, yes, you're right. African elephants are probably more hostile, if we want to use that word. But some Indian elephants can be very dangerous. The elephant, when it's in the wrong mood, is a dangerous creature. It can be tamed in all the ways we know, but there are examples, and I'm quite glad there are, to be quite honest, of elephants actually turning on cruel trainers. There's one really interesting story in my book about an elephant that was beaten over the head with a coconut, and the coconut shattered into loads of bits. The man that done it left the enclosure where the elephant was, and the elephant gathered up all the bits and kept them between his legs and wouldn't let anyone come near them. Then when the keeper came back into the enclosure 3 days later, the elephant immediately charged him, trampled him, killed him, and then went back to his pile of coconut pieces and one by one lifted them with his trunk and carried them to where the dead body was and dropped the pieces on the dead man. So let's just talk about Africa for a moment. It applies as well to Asia, but Africa, there are far more people in Africa now than there were, say, 50 years ago. And the big problem for elephants isn't ivory poaching. Ivory poaching is a horrible, horrible thing, and I'm not wishing to downplay that in any way. It's disgusting. But in terms of the numbers of elephants that are killed, probably ivory poaching doesn't represent that many statistically. What represents the statistical decline of the elephant is the use by man of more and more land. So there's fewer and fewer places for elephants to go. And as you just suggested, elephants need vast areas just to sustain themselves with food and things. They don't have any rules or laws. They will go wherever they want. So they will trample out crops and things that people have planted. They'll destroy villages, not deliberately, just passing through. And so local people often don't want them. I quoted something in the book. An African president, I can't remember who it was, said, "I'm always asked for more schools, for more hospitals, for more this, for more that. I'm never asked for more elephants." And I think that sums up the problem, that there are fewer and fewer places for elephants to go. And the fact that to local people, elephants are a great nuisance.
In a sense, the dispute depicted in Hayward Hardy's famous painting continues to this day.
Part 7.
The experiences of Maharaja and Lorenzo are a massive tribute to a man-animal relationship. But the experiences, the long walk, the unbreakable bond, and the ensuing fame were part of an everyday job. The walk and the bond, if they were unique only in their grand scale.
How much value do you put on an elephant?
Soon after this book was published in 1988, the painting by Hayward Hardy was offered for sale by Gerald Iles. It was bought first by a New York art dealer, who then sold it to the Manchester City Art Gallery. The disputed toll had come home.
Thank you very much indeed, Richard Collins. And more details about the disputed toll can be found on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. Next week, a repeat of a documentary about another famous work of art, Dürer's rhinoceros.
It is a landscape scale sheet of paper with a full scale, touching the borders of the sheet of paper, depiction of an animal seen from the side with a very big head that is put down, looking a bit sad also, and the rest of the sheet of paper is covered by the body, short legs, and the most part is the body that is covered by a kind of plate, like an armor of a knight. And the surfaces of these plates, let's say 7 or 8 different plates, is sprinkled with dots and small forms that give a shimmering experience to that, so that it really looks much more like a cloth than like a skin that we can see there. The animal's head is hairy, many hairs on that, and there is a very big horn at the end of the nose, and some other horns at the back that make it looking really dangerous. Nobody wants to come to next to this animal. Anyway, it looks not very happy, not very aggressive, but more calm. The eyes, wide, large eyes, open, a little bit melancholic, but melancholic is too difficult. Telling it with Dürer, he made another melancholic print, as you know. The inscription is very dominant. There is one dominant inscription. It tells us rhinoceros in big letters. The year 1515 is written above that, and Dürer's monogram, A.D., Albrecht Dürer, below this inscription. And then there is a text with several lines that tells us what we should know about this animal. It gives an explanation to this animal, that it appeared in Lisbon in this time. This is an actual news Dürer gives with this depiction. Then it describes it in detail. That is quite big and very powerful. And that there is one enemy that the rhinoceros has, that's the elephant, and that they do fight together. So for Dürer's single leaf prints, this is quite a lot of text information he puts into that.
That's a repeat of Dürer's Rhinoceros, another Mooney Goes Wild special, next Monday here on RTE Radio 1. In the meantime, you can visit our website, rte.ie/Mooney. Until next week, goodbye, goodbye, goodbye.
Mooney Goes Wild is presented and produced by Derek Mooney.
Email mooney@rte.ie.